In the Voice of Russia World Service, we present the program Red Line.
Welcome to the Voice of Russia and its weekend program, The Red Line. Every weekend, we, Sergei Strokan, Mira Salganik, and Ekaterina Kudashkina, invite you to discuss the most significant events of the week. We are joined by Russian and international experts, politicians, scientists and artists, sharing or opposing our views on the vast and increasingly interdependent world shared by all of us.
We want our program to be personal, provocative and fair.
So this week, we will start with the killing of Osama bin Laden in Pakistan, an event which has every chance to turn into the news of the year, with a fallout which can well be described as controversial, both for the home and foreign policy of the current U.S. administration. We will then switch over to a lighter, but no less historic news, a story of a fairy tale in politics, the royal wedding in Great Britain. And finally, we shall look into yet another historic event, a change of guard in the Tibetan movement, with the Dalai Lama being replaced by a new prime minister as a Tibetan leader.
You're right, so different events, and all in a way historic, so this is sort of a diversity of history.
Or historical diversity. Beyond the headlines, this is our first heading in which we will discuss an event that might look like a milestone in the global war on terror. President Obama's announcement that justice has been done, Osama bin Laden is dead, sent his popularity rating, as well as the world stock markets, by the way, soaring. In the few days that followed, investors have regained their usual poker attitude, and the international community, along with the wider public, started asking questions, and not always the easy one.
But the public mood is changing rapidly, but initial reaction was positive, Katya,
as
you remember, and the news was quickly hailed by the world leaders and governments in a rare moment of unity. That was surprising to me. You know, this is the feeling which was almost ousted from the international relations.
Well, that was a very emotional display of solidarity.
And unusual, Mira.
Yes, of course.
Perhaps unusual for the last decade.
Yes, indeed. Almost a decade. But this one was very emotional, very straightforward, passionate and sincere. And one thing, of course, it was primarily addressed to the Americans, but numerous victims of numerous other Al-Qaeda attacks were also remembered. And the bitter memories were evoked.
I wouldn't argue that. And messages of support and approval came from many world capitals, from Moscow and Paris to Amsterdam and Amman and Singapore, as well as from the Arab League. And you also might remember how nearly a decade ago, the world shocked by what it saw happening in New York on the 11th of September 2001, was too unified in their support and sympathy for the Americans. And some were saying that the forces of good, transcending all differences and tensions between them, were united against the forces of evil.
And that was the time when Putin called Bush.
Oh, yes. In fact, Russia's then-president Vladimir Putin was the first world leader to call George W. Bush to extend Russia's support for the U.S. in the global war on terror.
Yes, but who at the time could have known that it would finally bring the world to the ongoing wars in Afghanistan, in Iraq and today in Libya.
Yes, of course. Getting back to our story, in his televised address to the nation, President Obama, who initially positioned himself as the president of peace and got a Nobel Peace Prize, also found words of tribute to his predecessor. Perhaps he was a little bit too late in that.
An irony of history, yeah?
So he said that President of War, George W. Bush, who was for years unsuccessfully hunting the elusive Al-Qaeda leader in the mountains of Tora Bora, Afghanistan, deserved some respect and some credit for what actually came out of the decade-long hunt. And what's even more important, he called on the nation, and I quote, to think back to the sense of unity that prevailed on 9/11, adding, I know that it has at times frayed, and frayed it has. And Americans seem to be now divided on a whole range of important issues. However, their jubilation of bin Laden's death was something that brought them together, and it was extremely impressive in every sense of the word.
I've noticed that President Obama has strongly emphasized that bin Laden was not a Muslim leader. He was a mass murderer of Muslims, as Obama said.
He made that point several times.
Well, I don't want to speculate on how this statement will boost Obama's image and his domestic standing in terms of upcoming presidential election. There's no doubt that in 18 months before the vote, Republicans will try to...
They have already tried to do that.
But they will continue to do that. It will be not an easy ride for Obama, despite today's jubilant mood, but despite his ratings. I understand that.
But, Sergei, you have probably noticed how many questions the public is asking, how many questions internationally...
Already now.
And the number is growing and growing. I mean, the number of questions.
Yes, of course. And besides, there has also been some criticism in American press, which maintains that the present U.S. administration is unable to handle this situation, which is, in fact, generally seen as its victory, but they're losing their opportunities. They're not using their opportunities. They're losing information war.
No, Harikati, I think it's premature yet to judge whether it's losing or just a sort of, you know, maneuver. Anyway, this is not the point. We have been talking about this expression of goodwill, unity of nations.
Yes, and we're going on with our discussion.
And let me say that it didn't last long, right?
That's my point.
It's already evaporating.
Yes, it started actually evaporating just hours, if not minutes, after President Obama's speech, where he thanked Pakistan for cooperation, for sharing information, intelligence, and things. Well, as for the information shared, well, it's getting more and more questionable. But we don't have to go into that. What I wanted to bring to your attention is that immediately, India's Home Minister Chidambaram was very quick to point out, to remind, shall we say, the world audience, that it was in deep in Pakistan that Osama bin Laden was killed. And then he went on to add that this is sort of maintains our constant concern for Pakistan, which has become a harbor, a safety place for every terrorist organization.
But there's a slight remark. Well, in fact, there's been hardly any unity between India and Pakistan. So that's a natural reaction coming on the part of India.
This is a very natural reaction, but mind you, as I said, minutes, almost less than an hour after that. So the first reaction
coincides with the first reaction of Republicans in the U.S. Congress.
Indeed,
that's right.
Indeed. They also didn't lose time.
They never lost time.
But yet, what I want to elaborate on is not that in the Pakistani relations and Republicans respond, but Obama's remark about Osama bin Laden being a mass murderer of Muslims. Of course, this is true, though this is only a part of truth, you know. And my point is that Osama bin Laden started as murderer of my own compatriots, the Soviet soldiers in Afghanistan. And it was some 2 decades before September 11. And moreover, it is an open secret, though seldom mentioned in the Western media, that it was with the American support that a son of a wealthy building contract from Saudi Arabia transformed into the world's most wanted man, the ideologist and leader of Al-Qaeda.
But could you elaborate a little bit on that? Meaning, what do you mean with the U.S. support?
I mean, he's been trained
and financed, you see.
Meaning, he was trained in the U.S. training camps in Pakistan.
That we don't know. He's been in Peshawar.
Come on, you know that this was a Cold War time. And you know that Mujahideens were fighting against the Soviet intervention, how they called it, and Americans supported them. This is an open secret. And Osama bin Laden was a textbook example of that Mujahideen who raised due to American help.
Yes, I also heard that he invested his own money into Mujahideen movement. Is that correct?
You mean Osama bin Laden?
Yes,
that's
of course.
Right,
I wonder, expertise,
you see. We should not also omit that. Uh-huh. This is important.
No. I wonder about it because he was a young man, 20-something, a son of a wealthy businessman who did not approve his son's going to Afghanistan. Okay, that's all right. But he has been sort of recruited by CIA. Mm-hmm. Where exactly he was trained? Well, Katya, does it matter today?
Yes, it's an interesting detail.
Well, look, the very interesting detail, which is interesting for many reasons, that one is that I would not call it incidental that it was in Afghanistan in 1988 that somebody called Osama bin Laden has launched an organization, and he named it Al-Qaeda, which is Arabic for, you may call it basis, you may call it foundation, you may call the truth, something like this. But this, the rest is known. After a while, there was a round face, and he parted company with his former American tutors. And then, some time later, he turned arms against the Americans.
But this is what I'm saying, Mira, that the Al-Qaeda was born during the time of fight with Soviets.
Late 80s. So, and 3 decades later, Democratic President Barack Obama, in fact, kills the genie that had been let out of the bottle by the Republican U.S. President Ronald Reagan.
Yes, such a dramatic turnaround of history,
twist,
I would say.
Another twist.
Yeah, well, but
irony, irony.
But liquidation of Osama bin Laden sounds like a good news both for America and for the whole world, and obviously for Russia also, which is having problems with her own brand of followers of number one terrorist. I have a feeling that bin Laden's liquidation is not canceling Al-Qaeda's mythology.
Sure,
it might rather add to it.
Of course, he's become a martyr.
Yes, and I think that now comes the time to analyze the lesson taught to us all and to draw some practical conclusions
from
it.
What kind of lesson?
Well, the lesson is that we do live in a small and increasingly interdependent world, which is thickly sown with dragon's teeth.
But is there anything to be done with those dragon's teeth?
Well, first of all, let me tell you, that's what I think, and I don't think you will argue the point. The dragon teeth are mainly sown by that national egoism, which Sergei mentioned, I think it's an apt name, of the world powers plus their thrust for world dominance. Though they do live, like we do, in this small interdependent world, and I think the whole trend is dated, historically speaking. But just look around and you see where the trend is taking the world to.
Well, considering the present situation, it is taking the world to the wars in Afghanistan, in Iraq and Libya, and which might soon be followed by new ones, the trend.
I'm afraid it will.
That's a realistic, rather pessimistic forecast.
You know, it's a
realistic, I would call it.
I think it's a sheer coincidence that just days after Washington celebrations of the liquidation of Osama bin Laden, we hear in Moscow. We'll celebrate the victory in the 20th century war on terror, We Day, which marks the destruction of the monster of fascism. And obviously there will be a lot of music, flowers today. I've seen some last-minute preparations for the celebrations, a lot of fireworks and cheerful crowds in the streets.
But you know, to me it's always a very sad day because we all remember people who were killed.
Yeah, that's right.
And millions of people.
And the other sad thing is that the World War II veterans are coming to streets in less and less numbers. But what I want to say that we will also see veterans of Afghan war. And who knows, maybe some of them have faced in combat bin Laden. But none of them will tell.
None of them will know.
None of them could tell, probably, too.
But it's a very interesting, like you say, it is interdependent world. Look, in almost 50 issues of our program, we've been revisiting places. Is that correct? Is my understanding correct? Therefore, something that happened in Pakistan could backfire in the United States and around the world. And this is what Nicholas Gvozdev, professor of national security studies at the U.S. Naval War College, maintained. In fact, he has joined us to share some of his views on the problem, and to be more precise, on the relations between U.S. and Pakistan on the first hand. Thank you very much for joining us. I wanted to ask you several questions about the situation around Mr. bin Laden and the relations between the United States and Pakistan, because very controversial reports are coming in and media reaction is so diverse. Do you think this situation will somehow affect the relations between the United States and Pakistan?
It can affect them because of the role of public opinion and pressure groups in both countries. As we've seen in the United States, while the executive branch, the Obama administration, has stressed that the partnership with Pakistan continues and goes on and that relations are good between the two countries, you have the Congress as an actor intervening, being much more skeptical of the relationship with Pakistan, raising questions about what Pakistan, the government of Pakistan, knew or did not know in relationship to Osama bin Laden's ability to hide in that country for many years. And that may put pressure on the administration, which it does not want to exert, but Congress could end up creating a situation where it forces a reexamination of the U.S.-Pakistan relationship from Washington's perspective. In Pakistan, I think you have a civilian-led government that is anxious not to disrupt relations with the United States. The U.S. remains an important partner for Pakistan, but at the same time will also resist efforts to try to have greater clarity in what the intelligence agencies in Pakistan knew, what the military in Pakistan knew. This will raise new questions about whether or not terror groups in Pakistan have some degree of official protection, or at least the willingness of the government to turn a blind eye to their activities. This is something that, of course, the Indian government has alleged now for many years. But if this comes from the U.S. side as well, this could and the U.S. wants to have greater transparency in what's happening in Pakistan, this could produce a reaction, as we've seen on the ground. There's also the question of sovereignty. Pakistan has been very concerned about protecting its sovereignty. You had, for the last several years, constant tension to U.S. drone strikes, the use of drone aircraft to strike across the border into Pakistan against suspected militants. Now to have a special forces operation in Pakistan launched will raise these questions about whether the U.S. is respecting Pakistani sovereignty. So you have two governments that are trying to hold together the relationship and say that things can continue as they were, but on both sides of the relationship, there's now going to be much more pressure, which could have a negative impact.
Yesterday, I was talking to some Pakistani experts, and they were telling me that the ISI has been involved in planning the operation. And now they're kind of tracking back on those statements, and there is a statement by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Pakistan that it all came as a surprise. So what version is more viable? Do you think about that?
It's very difficult to tell. It's difficult to tell which versions are correct, which ones aren't. We have so much information that gets out there, different and competing and contradictory statements. And some of it also is related to the question of which audience you're appealing to. Obviously, you have some within the government that want to stress that this was part of the anti-terrorist cooperation with the United States, perhaps to forestall these calls from our Congress, from the U.S. Congress, to put greater pressure on Pakistan by saying, look, we were cooperating in this operation all the time. You have others that maybe don't want to have the sense that they were cooperating with the U.S. and want to downplay any sort of relationship that Pakistan was having with the U.S., where it looks like Pakistan is secretly working with the United States. You know, add to this, even before the capture of, the death of bin Laden, this operation, you already had a whole contretemps over whether or not the Pakistani prime minister had encouraged the Afghan president to ditch the United States and to go into a closer relationship with China, with people asserting that that was what would happen, and then complete denials of that occurring. So I think it's difficult now to tell what is the official story. As an observer here sitting in the United States looking at Pakistan, it's difficult to tell what the official story is. And it may reflect, as has been true with the government of Pakistan, that we talk about it as if it's a singular united entity. But in fact, it is made up of different components. There are different agencies. There are different groups within it who may be very easily pursuing different policy lines. And one, the right arm may not know what the left arm is doing or may not want to know what the left arm is doing. And it can allow for a certain degree of a mixed message is what I think what we're seeing here. But this brings back, though, I think the death of bin Laden and the operation that's occurred will be similar in a way to what happened immediate aftermath of 9/11 itself, where Pakistan and the government of Pakistan, as it did right in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, will have to make some fundamental choices. Its ability to hedge, to, on the one hand, be close with the United States, on the other hand, not to want to irritate some of the militant groups that are operating there. At some point, it will have to make, again, we'll be forced to make some choices, and we'll have to see how this plays out over the coming days and weeks in terms of the direction Pakistan chooses to go and the direction that the United States, frankly, wants to go, because you have those in the U.S. administration who want to continue a strong relationship with Pakistan. You have others who see this as a kind of last straw and who are more anxious to really develop the U.S. relationship with India and may see this as an excuse now to say that Pakistan is not a reliable partner for the United States, and this is why a more India-centric policy should be pursued.
This is the Voice of Russia.
And now we're turning to Redline's second heading, Between the Lines, in which we usually discuss what we consider to be the most notable publication of the week. This time, departing from our tradition to discuss publications of mainstream world media, we have selected a beautiful editorial piece from a reputable, though less known, Belfast Telegraph. So the piece is entitled Joyful Day of Love That We'll All Remember. It was published this Monday to sum up the first impressions of the British gala event of decades, Royal Wedding of Britain's Prince William and Kate Middleton. who got the titles of Duke and Duchess of Cambridge. So in a flood of publications on the royal wedding, which till the killing of bin Laden had remained the top story of the last weekend, this 500-word article stands nicely apart because it contains several uncommon observations made by our Northern Ireland colleagues, who, while being part of the British nation, still tend to see things in their own special way, with their typically Irish approach.
So what do they note?
Just let me quote. "The British," the article goes, "have a deserved reputation for being world leaders in the choreography and planning of major national occasions. And this royal wedding was no exception," the editorial says. According to Belfast Telegraph, this was an occasion for great joy at a time of relative gloom when the nation is experiencing a difficult economic downturn and is embroiled in distressing conflicts abroad. It's a nice contrast.
Yeah, you said an occasion for great joy at a time of relative gloom. Yes,
that's right.
Okay, that's well said. And I was watching the ceremony on Russian TV more than once, and I was surprised that almost on every channel of Russian state TV.
And almost all the
show. Yeah. And do you know what was my impression? It was not only a day of joy, and not only a very personal occasion for the Britain's most attractive young couple. It was also the kind of event that was generating optimism.
Yes.
It was generating that sort of positive national attitude, which is so badly needed by the British today, I presume, when the nation is faced with mounting domestic problems.
And just let me go on with your logic. It is badly needed by the whole of the world, with so many grim news coming in about wars, about floods, about illnesses, about catastrophes. And now we had a fairy tale.
British fairy tale.
Just a fairy tale. A boy meets a girl or otherwise, and that's
a girl,
happy.
A girl marries a prince.
Yes.
Which is
a universal fairy tale.
You're absolutely right, Mira. So just to quote Belfast Telegraph, it was a marvelous spectacle of pageantry with the pomp and circumstance of church and state on full display. And I tell you that the picture, which was aired by the TV, was one of the fairy tales. I think you'll agree with that.
I think the whole of Russia perceived it as a fairy tale.
Of course.
Why not? Similar perception of the same thing, you know, fairy tale-ishness, I don't know how to put it, fairy tale thing, was voiced by not the small Belfast thing, but one of the biggest British, biggest selling newspapers, The Sun. The front page story was just a huge photograph of the unforgettable, unprecedented double kiss on the balcony of Buckingham Palace. Well, the paper wrote that the wedding has given the country a lift at a time when the deep public spending cuts and domestic austerities were on everybody's mind.
You're absolutely right.
Mira, I have seen that editorial, and it also said that Britain showed the world that it is in good heart, capable and open for business.
Well, so they owe this to Kate and William. Oh, I'm sorry, to Duke and Duchess of Cambridge.
Because to William and Catherine.
Yes, Sir William and Catherine, for giving them a case to show their good spirit and readiness for business.
This is also the reason why every detail was impressive, from the magnificence of the very British music to the classic simplicity of the wedding dress, as Belfast Telegraph put it. And it also noted that the traditional church service underlined the majesty of the occasion, as well as the Christian teaching on marriage. You know, I've read a number of reports, and I had a general impression that people were missing those small moments of fairy tales in their grey lives.
But one may also say that it was an event of a striking balance between tradition and signs of a new modern monarchy, wasn't it?
What kind of new modern monarchy signs?
Yes, right, when Sir Elton John was invited with his house. Well, that was very modern, no?
Extremely modern to my taste, if you ask me. Well, but I'm a conservative,
I mean, it was just a question because I knew your reply. I feel the same.
Thank you, Mira. I always cherish your support. But there was also, I think you were telling me something about an interesting story which you ran across in a Polish newspaper.
That's it. There is that Polish paper which is called Gazeta Wyborcza, which is a very popular paper with a well-established reputation. And the paper said that Kate Middleton is the embodiment of the image, is the image of the middle-class girl who snared a prince of monarchy.
Oh, Jesus, that's a dissonance.
No, it's not a dissonance. This is what every girl, I mean, whether she's trying to snare a prince or somebody...
Or she's dreaming of it.
She's dreaming of it. Sometimes it comes true. Why should you be so envious of it, Katya?
No, I'm not.
I hope not. To divert your attention a little bit. Mind you, the show has been watched, just think of it, by almost a third of this globe's population.
That's what I...
2 billion people.
That's what I mean.
This is truly fantastic.
People crave for beautiful stories.
Crave for hope.
People crave for hope. People crave for optimism.
Well, you know, the swearing helped, this is what the Polish paper underlined, to renew monarchy's a bit dusty image.
Oh, yes.
By making it rather modern.
Perhaps they have a point. Just let me quote again from the Belfast Telegraph story. Every detail was broadcast live to a massive international audience and those watching and listening, as well as the thousands in Westminster Abbey and those who lined the route, could truly believe that they were witnessing history being made. And this makes it an exceptional image-building event for the monarchy, like you said, Mira.
But this particular statement sounds a bit too grandiloquent to me. I think that it could have been slightly toned down.
I agree, Mira. And the week after, the royal wedding proved it, and that Westminster party is over, as well as the old drum beaten over the renewed image of ever-shining glory of the British crown.
Sergei, what you're doing now, you're shattering a dream that has been long craved for.
One wakes up after a dream, no?
I'm not sure that every awakening is welcome.
It happens anyway.
Most of the time.
Yes.
So a week after the party, British...
Thanks for reminding.
But fairy tale has its end. Every fairy tale has its end.
You're sounding so realistic. But look, British anti-monarchists are now attacking the BBC for what they call a complete lack of impartiality in its coverage of the royal wedding. So, like you say, Sergei, welcome back to reality.
But when you say back to reality, what do you mean?
Sergei, that's just another down-to-earth story. So the pressure group called Republic, which campaigns for the abolition of monarchy, said that the BBC compromised the high standards of journalism in favor of PR on behalf of the royal family while covering the monarchy in the run-up to and during the royal wedding. But I really wonder how could BBC...
So they're attacking corporations.
Well, that's nothing new about attacking corporations.
I think it looks like an act of despair. Obviously, it was not their anti-monarchist day. It was not their party.
I don't think that the rating of monarchy shot up after that event. It was just that all people who live in Britain were united in some very positive spirit. And that is all. They could be supporters of monarchy. They could be supporters of the republic.
But there should have been some who would say no.
Yes. That's the grim reality of everyday politics. So Graham Smith, the Republic's campaign manager, said, let me quote, "The BBC has gone completely into promotional mode. The tone and content of its coverage has gone way beyond psychofancy to the point where it is acting as a public relations channel for the Windsors." Really, I find it absolutely senseless. And all in all, now they want to file complaints with the BBC's Director General, along with the BBC Trust, which oversees the corporation and acts in the interests of license payers.
But I think that's... Back to earth.
Right.
The first scandal after the wedding, as it should come, but a bit too soon.
Again and again, I may sound too philosophical, but reality is the thing that doesn't let parties last too long. Even the royal party, so the fairy tale is over. And now
the reality is killing fairy tales.
And now it is reported that the royal couple had to delay their honeymoon because of Bin Laden liquidation.
Oh,
so again, Bin Laden comes out.
Do you
I don't know, but it is reported that the decision was taken for security reasons.
Oh, Sergei, listen, this is absolute rubbish. Absolute rubbish. Well, the royal couple suggested that they want to be left alone, which is normal thing to do.
Especially for Prince William.
Yes.
Who has been hurt by the press, by the media, and by tabloids.
True. But another story, that of Osama bin Laden, that's continuous. Because there were sort of unconfirmed yet, but still warnings of terrorist attacks on the British nuclear sites. So what the Belfast Telegraph said, that, I mean, there is time for everything, and the disaster and the gloom still don't disappear.
They don't, and they won't disappear, unfortunately.
They go nowhere.
Let's be upbeat. And now I'm happy to introduce our guest, who is a well-known British journalist based with the independent newspaper Christina Patterson. And she has been following this problem for quite a while.
What was your impression of this brilliant day?
It was just a very happy day, really. And what was strange was that all kinds of people who one wouldn't expect to be enthusiastic about a royal wedding, including me, actually, really quite caught up in the whole thing. And I think people just felt it was a very touching, lovely spectacle. And it didn't feel as though it had an enormous amount to do with the monarchy or the aristocracy or the structures of this country. It just felt as though it was celebrating the wedding of two people who, as far as we can tell, seem really rather nice.
To me, it actually seemed a very beautiful, like you say, spectacle. It was beautiful, and it really was a very welcome contrast to the grim days some of us are living through. I mean, there's a lot of unrest, there's a lot of bad news coming from all corners of the world, and now we saw something really beautiful. And I just wanted to ask, you wrote a good phrase in your story, which is, we were not here because we believed, as we wanted to 30 years ago, in fairy tales, but because we wanted to believe in happiness. But do you think that there is still some place for a fairy tale in our lives?
Well, actually, I wrote a column about that yesterday.
Oh, really?
Fairy tales. Yes. What I was writing about, actually, was the fact that there were three big celebrations over the weekend, and one was the one in London, which was for a kind of fairy tale, and one was for the one in Rome about the beatification of John Paul, which was for another kind of fairy tale, and one was for the death of Osama bin Laden on Sunday night, which was for another kind of fairy tale, which was kind of which is dead. And what I was arguing in my column yesterday was that fairy tales are dangerous, and on the whole, they distort things, and it's not a great idea to subscribe to them. But I think it kind of depends what you mean by a fairy tale. I mean, in terms of the royal story, I don't think anyone believes in the way that we did with Princess Diana and Prince Charles, that, you know, this actually was a fairy tale and that everything would be happy ever after. I mean, maybe some people do, but I don't think most people sort of think that way anymore. I think what they felt was that here were two young people who clearly loved each other and had known each other for a long time and had had their love tested, and who were going to make a go of it. And I'm sure that it's very aware, you know, it's very obvious to everyone that the press are not going to give them an easy time. Prince William believes that the press killed his mother, and he may or may not be right. But, you know, the press have got an appetite now for William and Kate that's not going to go away. And we don't know when the Queen's going to die, and we don't know when Charles is going to become king, and we don't know when William's going to become king. But nobody's very keen on Charles. So, you know, I mean, I'm sure if William became king tomorrow, everyone would be delighted, but that's not going to happen. So I don't think it's, you know, really about a fairy tale. It's about something nice that happened, and it was about just celebrating that something nice was happening and that it made a pleasant change from, as you say, all the horrible things that are happening all the time.
That's right. And it was rather surprising for me, though, that all headlines, they seem to be focusing very eagerly on some horror stories. Okay, and this time everybody was so excited about something positive. But actually you said that fairy tales are dangerous. Why?
Because they're distorting. I think, well, for a start, they're wrong. I mean, life is not made up of fairy tales, and they can lead people into dangerous behavior. I mean, the Bin Laden fairy tale, Bin Laden propagated one fairy tale, which was that there was the great Satan, and the great Satan had to be defeated, and hundreds of thousands of people had died as a result of that fairy tale. And America joined into that fairy tale by thinking that it was a battle between good and evil, when, of course, all conflicts are infinitely more complicated than that. And as a non-believer, I think that the fairy tale of people performing miracles through a pope is also pretty dangerous. I mean, the Catholic God, or the Pope, said better for people to die of AIDS than to use a condom. So that's clearly a very dangerous fairy tale.
The public still wants something positive. So do you think that there should be a limited amount of fairy tales in this life? Or perhaps they're still too dangerous? I can see your point. I can see what you mean when you're saying that clichés, to put it another way, are dangerous. And the fairy tales are clichés. There are some romantic clichés. But then being always down to earth, isn't it a bit boring?
I mean, not everything in life is grim and miserable. Unfortunately, quite a lot is. You can believe in the happiness of people, and you can believe in love without believing in fairy tales. I mean, you know, clearly there are plenty of very happy marriages around, and it's perfectly possible that this will be a happy marriage. It's extremely unlikely that nothing will ever go wrong in either of their lives, because life tends seems not to be like that. But, you know, it could be that from here on, things will largely be very good, and that would be nice, and be nicer than it is for most people. So I'm happy to hope for them, but we simply don't know, because death is part of the cycle of life, and so is illness, and so other kinds of suffering. And fairy tales are fairy tales. That's not life.
At least BBC seems to be suffering a little bit about after their coverage of the wedding, because I think that there were some pressure groups, or like they're called now, insisting that the BBC has not been impartial in their coverage. So what sense does that make? I mean, why did those pressure groups, how could a company like BBC be partial or impartial in their coverage of a royal wedding?
I mean, people are always making a fuss about things like that. I assume that what the pressure groups are saying was that the coverage was too sycophantic or whatever, but I think that's missing the point, because I don't think it was a great celebration of the monarchy. I really don't think most British people care one way or the other about the monarchy. I think they like the Queen. I think they respect her because she's very hardworking and very dutiful. So far they like William, and so far they like Kate. They don't particularly like Charles. But I think it's a mistake to present Britain as this nation of monarchists, and I think it's a mistake to say that the BBC's coverage was deferential. I don't think Britain is a deferential nation anymore, really. I think that was just, you know, I mean, it's quite hard to fill the airwaves for days and days with speculation about a dress or the bridesmaid's bottom or whatever else it might be. I think just kind of filling time.
Perhaps they're just trying to gain some political momentum from an event that seems to be absolutely non-political. Is that correct?
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, The Independent, you know, which I worked for years, has largely been a Republican newspaper. I would probably have said that I was Republican, but I think the trouble is that when people think about the alternatives and they think about having an elected president, an old man in a suit, it doesn't feel like a particularly appealing alternative. And apart from the cost of the royal family, you know, one might argue that they don't necessarily do all that much harm, given that it's largely symbolic. I mean, I don't like the symbols of an aristocracy or of a monarchy, but I wouldn't begrudge these people their happiness on this day.
This is the Voice of Russia.
And now we move on to Redline's concluding heading, Man in the News. This week it is going to be a newcomer to newsmakers, so to say, Mr. Lobsang Sangye, the newly elected Prime Minister of Tibet. So the question is there life for Tibet movement after the departure of Dalai Lama, seen as the world's spiritual authority and, in fact, a symbol of Tibet outside it? So could a new Prime Minister with a Harvard background, with less charisma than his predecessor, represent the case of Tibet in the international community? Yet it is reported that the Dalai Lama was very happy that people had taken a very active part in the election process, and now it is Lobsang Sangye who will take on the political role previously played by the Dalai Lama. So my question is, Sergei, how successfully do you think he would play this role?
But you know, Katya, to answer the question, I think that first we have to understand what sort of a person is the new leader of Tibet, how he was propelled to power in almost non-existent Tibet state.
Okay, let's go into details. So first of all, to be more precise, it were the Tibetans in exile who have elected their new political leader, Lobsang Sangye. Now, as far as I understand, he was born in India, he's 42 years old, he has academic background, and he spent the past 15 years at Harvard University, if I'm not mistaken. But he has never been in his native land of Tibet. So Lobsang Sangye won 55% of the vote cast by Tibetans around the world, defeating two other candidates in the election held in March. Sergei, please correct me if I'm wrong.
That's right, but he looks like an outsider still for Tibet.
Outsider to whom?
He knows very little of Tibet, and he was elected by Tibetans from outside Tibet, as Katya said.
Well, not outside of Tibet. He was elected by Tibetan diaspora. Let's be more correct about it, number one. Secondly, you know full well that no election of a prime minister of Tibetan government is possible in, shall we call it, inner Tibet. Out of the question.
The result of the vote was announced last Wednesday in Dharamsala, India, where the Tibetan government in exile is based, and Lobsang Sangay is going to take office in August when the current government's mandate runs out. So, in a victory statement, he said, and just let me quote, "I urge every Tibetan and friend of Tibet to join me in our common cause to alleviate the suffering of Tibetans in occupied Tibet and to return His Holiness to His rightful place." Mira, what His Holiness he's referring to?
Oh, I mean the Dalai Lama, of course.
But wasn't it the Dalai Lama who said he's stepping down himself?
Well, it needs an explanation of sorts. The point is that Dalai Lama cannot step from being the Dalai Lama because he's the living God.
Yes, but
so but he said that he's stepping down from political leadership because he wants, number one, a younger person to take over. Secondly, he put a lot of emphasis on the democratic election, which has been, from what we know, conducted. One of the reasons is that there are, I mean, opponents of the Dalai Lama who accuse him of trying to re-establish or give a new lease of life on theocratic rule in Tibet. He tries, and he does it successfully, to show that no, he would like the autonomy of the Tibetans be preserved. He is for democracy, for modern development, but their culture, that's why, remember, he uses it quite often. He says that what Chinese are perpetrating against the Tibetans is cultural genocide.
As a follow-up to what Mira said, this much, the Dalai Lama, who is the living god for millions of Buddhists, has announced his decision to devolve his authority in the best interests of Tibetan people, as he put it. And that decision was obviously prompted by his growing concern over who will lead the Tibet resistance movement in the future.
Exactly.
As far as I understand, BBC's Mark Dummett points out in one of his program, and as far as I understand, he's been following the whole situation. Please tell me whether he's wrong or not. Let me quote, "Lobsang Sangay has the daunting task of trying to keep the issue of Tibet alive, while the man who embodies the struggle for Tibetan rights gradually steps back from the limelight." How would you comment on this?
Well, if you ask me, I'd say that Dummett is quite right. And Dalai Lama's gradual, shall we say, eclipse means a great loss for the cause of independent or at least autonomous Tibet. On the other hand, Dalai Lama said that he was going to do it, and I would agree that it's a daunting task for the new prime minister. But I would add that he's facing, at the same time, another task not less daunting. The Dalai Lama was the presence of cohesion, I make myself clear, of Tibetans inside Tibet and the diaspora, number one. Secondly, inside Tibet, where there are many sects of Buddhism, many clashing currents, only the Dalai Lama, with his spiritual authority, could make them into a kind of a whole. Whether or not Lobsang Sangay will be capable of doing it, well, my answer will be no.
But we're already discussing his problems, you see, or the task he's facing. But I think we have just to say a few words about him, because still he is enigma. He is not known, you see.
His parents were refugees from Tibet. Actually, his father was a monk who had to flee in the same year as the Dalai Lama did after the Chinese military destroyed his monastery when they came to India. Well, actually, his father and mother were married in India. Not that it matters. They started farming. And so that's the phrase that everybody repeats when Lobsang Sangay said that I owe almost everything to a cow.
To a cow?
Yes, Sergei, but he means...
This has nothing to do with Hindu, no?
No, he's a Vajrayana Buddhist, for God's sake. Well, look, he was referring to the fact of his biography. The father had to sell a cow to pay for his schooling fees. That was all. But actually, by putting him to a good school, I mean Lobsang, young
Lobsang. What a moving story, Mira.
Look, I didn't want to repeat sort of, you know, sentiments of the royal wedding.
Just yes, another fairy tale.
I suppose Amira's point was not to make you cry, Sergei, but I also read that Delhi University, he joined the Tibetan Youth Congress.
Which was only to be expected.
Why?
Because at that time, that Youth Congress was the fiery, you know, sort of anti-Chinese fight. This is something which Dalai Lama opposed simply because he was afraid.
For those youth?
Right. Then he was, he's obviously got a very gifted boy. After Delhi, where he was sharing his time between studies and street manifestations against the Chinese, down with this and down with that. He got a Fulbright stipend.
What's that?
A Fulbright stipend. He got a special kind of stipend, which is offered to young men of less developed or remote countries. To put it in a nutshell, to the young people who normally would hardly have a chance to get a proper education. So this time, I guess, Fulbright committee made a good choice, because he proved to be, not that this proves anything at all, he proved to be the first Tibetan to obtain a doctorate in international law from Harvard.
From Harvard,
yeah.
Yes. Is he still calling for the independence of Tibet?
No, he never uttered the word.
Since when?
Since he dropped his young student, you know, sloganeering.
Right.
And he moderated his views. Now he said that he supports the Dalai Lama stand on it. And Dalai Lama calls upon Tibetans to try to get it and the Chinese to concede it. Genuine cultural autonomy, meaning that he doesn't want the Chinese Hans huge influx into Tibet, which is ousting the local population. And most of all, he is against communist indoctrination on Tibet.
So judging by what you said, to sum it up, it looks like the exiled Tibetans have elected a man who has almost no experience of his homeland and none of the government. And his government education, as I understand, might help him to deal with the Western supporters of Tibet, but not with the Chinese authorities.
Not at all.
No way, yeah. Even the Dalai Lama's numerous attempts at a dialogue brought no results, let me remind you.
Nine of them.
Let me ask you a question. Where is most of the Tibetan diaspora located? India? Or perhaps has it moved somewhere to the Western countries?
Well,
Europe we have...
You have diaspora in many European countries.
How about the United States?
Yes, there too.
So perhaps he would be more useful with his Western background.
Well, he will be used in this sense. He's useful to establish contacts, and he will have good contacts with the Western academic world, with politicians, with sympathizers.
But that is also important for retaining Tibetan culture.
Not only culture. It is important to retain the spirit of Tibetan resistance outside Tibet, because you know that the Dalai Lama, with his Nobel Prize and his authority, he could get donations, he could get support. You know how popular he is among the men of culture, among the men of science, and then he's a unique personality. There is no comparison. Well, look here, to sum it up, the middle way and the nonviolence have always been the Dalai Lama's mantras. And it was these mantras that mainly attracted to him plenty of supporters, sympathizers outside the Tibet. And moreover, it was a way he attracted many people to Buddhism. I mean, the interest of Buddhism was not so high before the Dalai Lama started his activities. It is interesting, but we're talking of something else, and don't let me get diverted from it. The mantras have not taken the Tibetans not and not closer to their ideal, and that is the normal existence in normal milieu of their country without the Chinese degradation, repression, which is becoming systemic.
This is true, Mira, and moreover, some young Tibetan activists believe that all pacifism doesn't work. And although most approve of the Dalai Lama's leadership, there's a growing number of people who are calling for a tougher line.
Exactly. Well,
now, look, since analysts of Tibetan politics believe that too many Tibetans, Lobsang Sangye does represent the younger generation of Tibetans, so he must be their man with his pre-election rhetoric of innovation, self-reliance, and equality. By the way, being only 42 years of age, he really is young for a prime minister. And of course, now all depends on his performance. So far, he has never said a word like independence or sovereignty. Am I correct?
You are absolutely correct. As the head of a government in exile, I'd like to stress this. He has to be cautious on more reasons than one. It should be remembered that while we are talking about Dharamsala being the North End and things, Tibetans are exiles in India, not citizens of India. And so the Prime Minister has to be very cautious, because India is feeling increasingly less and less comfortable with Tibetans in its territory, and China, the strong and contentious and Should we go on describing it? Neighbor.
Well, and China seems to be adamant on crushing Tibetan resistance.
Absolutely.
Once and for all time. And partly to preclude a domino effect inside China itself, with disturbances in other ethnic minority areas such as Xinjiang, Inner Mongolia, and
Gansu,
other places.
Gansu.
Gansu, yeah.
So, it all sounds absolutely incredible, but here is what The Guardian writes. And just let me quote again. Earlier this week, Beijing has ordered that the 15th Dalai Lama must be born in China and will be recognized by the government authority. I'm really sorry, but what do they mean, must be born in China?
I mean, he shouldn't be
a citizen
identified as a new incarnation in exile. He ought to be born in China. Why in China? I can tell you, should I?
Why not in Tibet?
Tibet is China from the point of view of Chinese authorities.
Okay.
So Tibet is okay. Look, why don't I tell you what's coming next? To all probability, Beijing now will find a young little boy, a son of a loyal ethnic Tibetan, a good communist, make this boy the Dalai Lama, then pressure all the European governments and international politics to recognize this boy and not the one who would be identified by the lamas in the traditional manner in Tibet or India.
Which implies that we're soon going to see two Dalai Lamas coexisting in this interdependent world of ours.
that's
no,
really
Kat,
fantastic.
I totally disagree. They won't coexist. There will be a standoff. And trying to mediate this standoff will be the biggest problem of the poor Harvard academic, now the Prime Minister of Tibet.
Who is there for non-violence?
Oh, he is for non-violence.
So two Dalai Lamas at a time.
All the three of them will be for non-violence.
Since they are Buddhists.
Of course, they are. Two of them would be Dalai Lamas, one fake one.
One not. Fantastic.
Really fantastic what I said. And it means that Sangay's problems might be even worse than Dalai Lamas. And they can include not just resistance to what they call cultural genocide, but also a standoff between two living gods.
Extraordinary.
This is new development.
So we need an expert to sort that out.
And now we might turn to Nandan Unnikrishnan, senior fellow at the Observer Research Forum in New Delhi, India.
Of course, what is important to remember is that the Dalai Lama has laid down all political aspects of his role till now and has handed it over in that sense to the Tibetan government in exile. So whether there will be any changes is something that we cannot predict at this stage. Undoubtedly, nobody will be as popular as the Dalai Lama. But you have to take into account that it's the Tibetan community across the world that voted in the election. And he's come through an election, so he is undoubtedly, in that sense, popular choice. The Chinese have reacted negatively to the election of Sangay. They view him probably as a negative influence because of his political history. He was a leader of the Tibetan Youth Congress. And the Chinese blame the Tibetan Youth Congress for the riots that took place in Tibet a couple of years ago. Therefore, I can understand the Chinese skepticism, if I put it mildly, about Mr. Sangay's election.
Right, which means that Mr. Sangay is going to find it difficult to bring together the Tibetans who live in Tibet now and the Tibetans who live around the world, the rest of them.
Well, I would not go to that extent because I think there is a very strong synergy between the Tibetans living in China and the Tibetans who are living outside. I think broadly they are all reading from the same page. But the issue which will arise is, will Sangay attempt to make any tactical changes from the positions that the Dalai Lama used to take, now that the Dalai Lama has given up any kind of political role? And if he does, how will the reaction be to those changes?
And what do you think about that? Will he?
Well, this is more, I suppose, in some ways a philosophical question. Since Mr. Sangay represents a generational change, he's a completely new generation as opposed to the political leaders of the Tibetan exiles, I suspect there will be some changes and nuance. But broadly, as long as the Dalai Lama is alive, I do not expect any significant changes.
Which is good.
Which, yes, I suppose, given the context, is a good thing.
Mr. Unnikrishnan, thank you very much.
And with this, we end this edition of Red Line, brought to you by the Voice of Russia radio station. It was presented by its founders, Sergei Strokin and Mira Salganik, and myself, Ekaterina Kudashkina. Thank you very much for staying with us. Goodbye, and take care.
Take care, and goodbye.
So long.
Goodbye.
So long.
Goodbye.
So long.
Goodbye.
So long.
Goodbye. Goodbye.
So long.
Goodbye.
So long.